Accession number 18625, Reel 2.
Dr. Bardell, Reel 2.
I was talking about the Negro band, and I was saying it really was so smart, and of course it was quite unexpected, so we were astonished, and I think some of the troops seemed to be so delighted with it, because I think they thought it would annoy the senior officers that something so unmilitary should be there to welcome them in. I really can't see them. The senior officers were probably thoroughly enjoyed it themselves, but I think they felt that their moustaches may be bristling a little bit too much. Then we went on the quay, and again I've got pictures of me stood with Gus Jones, the Church of England padre, and Terry Quinlan, the Catholic priest. Then we got on a train, which was a wooden, well, it was sort of hard class, you might call it that. And that was to take us to an assembly area fairly near to Taegu. But just as it was about to drive to pull out of Pusan, another train came in with a lot of American badly wounded soldiers on board. And this was rather disconcerting to us, to say the least, because we could see them lying there on their stretchers and their bandages and things. But I think they were just evacuating the most badly wounded. Anyway, then we set off, and I think we travelled through the night, and I can't remember anything after that until finishing up in this assembly area, which was in a big field, as I remember it, and on the right-hand side, as I looked into the field, was a stream. And I wanted to go to the lavatory. And at that time, I hadn't got used, I was still a little bit too embarrassed to go and dig myself a hole. After a time, you don't bother, you just go and do that. And then I noticed that there was someone had built a lavatory in the middle of the field. So I said, well, that's fine, it's not so bad after all. So I went to it. And shortly afterwards, the adjutant, a chap called Nick Carter, came over to me. He's in Australia now, I believe. And he informed me that that was for the commanding officer and for no one else. So after that, one had to get used to taking a spade into the woods or whatever was nearby. And we were there for, I don't know how long, I can't remember, probably one or two days. And at that time, the North Koreans were attacking strongly, and this was we were just on the edge of the Pusan perimeter. And then we moved from there into our first positions, and battalion headquarters were set up, and the various companies were spread out, going with, I think the Argylls were on our left flank, and we were defending an area on the River Nakdong, which had been covered formerly by American troops. I don't know who they were, but they'd obviously been withdrawn for a rest, I think. That was a time of relative peace. I can remember that, again, I've got pictures of this. I can remember that we put strings at the back of the regimental aid post, because there was a village, went right up towards the hills at the back, and we put strings with tin cans and stones in them to make sure that if anyone tried to come in the night, we'd hear them. I can remember there was a big screen that they, one big camouflage screen that they put over the road so that they couldn't see from the other side of the River Nakdong, which was about 2 miles away, I suppose, mile and a half, 2 miles away. And the North Koreans were on the other side. One or two things disturbed me there, and I can remember a series of trucks, and the Catholic priest and I had piled up, because I'm not Catholic, but I got on very well with him, and I used to lend him my regimental aid post tent so that he could take his Catholics in and they could say Mass, you see. This was very suitable for him. And we got on famously. But we noticed these trucks going into the hills, crowded with people, and they were coming back empty. And from what we've read since, I can only assume that these were South Korean people taking people up into the hills and executing them. I can't think what else it could have been. There have been reports of this type of atrocity. And one didn't really think that they would do that. So we didn't report it. There's nothing much we didn't do anything about it because we thought must have thought they were just being transported somewhere else, and which they may have been, but it seemed very odd to take them into the hills and trucks come back empty. I was called out on another occasion. I was called out one night to see someone in the Argyles. Don't know where Doug Haldane was. He might have been called away or doing something, you see. But I know I got a call, would I go across to the Argyle positions? And I remember I had to go in a jeep in the middle of the night, and there were three or four soldiers on it, armed to the teeth, because there were roving North Korean patrols. And I got there, and I thought, from what I'd been told, that this was an Argyle with an appendicitis. But I think he'd just been eating apples, and he just got tummy ache when I got there. So it wasn't so bad. But it was a bit scary. Then nothing much happened there. There was one or two tragedies, and one or two people were killed down by the river. I think someone had a crash in a car. And then the battalion was moved because the time for the breakout from the Pusan perimeter was coming. And the battalion was moved to another position. Again, I could show you on the map roughly where it was, but if you just imagine that we probably went a few miles up the river and settled into positions which were perhaps 500 or 600 yards from the river itself on a fairly flat plain, presumably paddy field. And there were already foxholes on this particular area, so we'd somewhere to go if trouble started. And we hadn't been there very long before we were shelled. And it was the first time we'd been shelled. And everyone was scared stiff, and they jumped down holes. And I think that my sergeant, Bailey, jumped down the same hole as the second in command, who was called Rowley Gwynn. And anyway, Bailey broke his arm, I think, and had to go back at that point. But Terry Quinlan, the priest, who was very experienced, I'll never forget him getting up in the middle of the shelling, and he was going round from foxhole to foxhole, just saying, you know, you don't need to, and with his walking stick, saying, you don't need to worry, these are not high explosive shells coming in, these are anti-tank shells. So he'd recognised this, and no one else did, and everyone was just scared stiff. Anyway, after that, it was deemed prudent to pull a bit further back, which we did, and on the way back we passed an American field hospital, and we went past it and then went further back, and the battalion headquarters were set up another half mile back or something like that behind this field hospital. And I think we were probably out of range of the shelling there, and I can remember going to this hospital, and they had a great big courtyard, and they were having steaks with the Americans. They had a field kitchen in their main courtyard, and they had the terrifically fat steaks. And on the top they had red crosses. I've been told not to wear my Red Cross armband because they said the North Koreans would shoot at it. You see. I suppose the rationale it was that if you got rid of someone who could make people better, it seemed a bit ridiculous. But we didn't. I didn't wear it, and neither did anyone else, any of the other medics. But this hospital had red crosses on top of it, and there was a road besides it, just at the entrance to the hospital, and down which came some tanks, some American tanks. Now, this gun opened fire on those tanks as they came past the hospital, but no shells went near the hospital, which struck me that the idea that the North Koreans didn't respect the Red Cross was probably just a bit of propaganda. Because there were other bits of propaganda that we didn't quite understand. I remember going with, particularly with Gus Jones, the Church of England padre, and he and I would take his hymn books out for him. If there'd been a bit of action, I took the hymn books out, and Gus, we always had a good congregation if there'd been a bit of trouble. And Gus always said, you know, there's nothing like a few shells for packing the services out. But we, when we went into a village, I'm going on a little bit, but when we went into a village that perhaps we'd taken, we'd find, to our amazement, particularly in North Korea, that the churches were open and obviously had just been used, they'd just been evacuated. So the idea that all churches were closed down and Christianity suppressed was, to my mind, again, a bit more propaganda, I think. Not entirely true. Although, my wife and I have been to Russia, and clearly the communist, and this was in the early 70s, communist ideology there was anti-religion, which is part of the communist philosophy, isn't it? And I remember someone saying to the in-tourist guide, is there a church service anywhere? And the in-tourist guide, a woman, said, if you believe in that sort of thing, there is somewhere you can go, I'll let you know. So that was just to illustrate the point that I was making before. But to revert to the positions just behind the hospital that I was telling you about, which wasn't shelled, it was at that point that, having crossed the River Nektong, that the Argylls and Sutherland Highlanders were napalmed by the American Air Force. You've probably heard about that, have you?
Yes.
And they had apparently, as I understand it, taken a hill. And for some reason there was confusion with, I was told it was with the, there used to be big sort of recognition panels to put out on top of a hill so that the aircraft could say, well, that's, they're on our side. And these would change every day. The pattern would change every day. But anyway, something went wrong, and I think the Argylls had asked for an airstrike, and it didn't come in. For some reason, it was delayed. And so they took the hill, and having taken it, the airstrike came in. And what would happen in those days, they would have Mustang aircraft, which were coming from the last war, and they would, four fighters would come in, and they would go in with, first of all, rockets, I think, and then napalm, and then they would strafe. They would go in one after another, and each plane would shoot its rockets into the target, then each plane would go in with its napalm, and then afterwards they would machine gun. And this is what happened to the Argylls. And I think Doug Haldane, who was up there with Argyll Battalion headquarters, treated them as far as it was possible to treat them. But this is the main thing with casualties, is that if there's trouble going on, their main concern is to get back. They want to get out of the firing lane to where they're safe. And they had to come back, and they were evacuated across this pontoon bridge, which had been shelled by just one very accurate gun, which, so we were told later, could not be located because it was kept in a cave, and it was brought out for shelling when there were no aircraft about, and it could be quickly pulled back. So I went down and helped with the evacuation of their casualties over this pontoon bridge. And I just don't know what would happen to those chaps afterwards. We just shot them straight back. There was nothing much we could do for them. The main thing was to get them back under proper medical care. And that's why I've always, wonder whether I can see that a doctor is good for morale. You've got to have someone there who troops can think, well, if something goes wrong, there's someone there to treat me. But whether in practice you can do an awful lot, I don't know. Not actually up at the front with the battalions. You can probably do a little bit at your regimental aid post, but you haven't got the facilities to do the sort of thing that is done at field hospitals, or in our case, we didn't have, field hospital wasn't there. We were evacuating to the Americans, you see. But those boys were very badly burned, and their clothing was burned off, and their faces were black with it, and they were blistered. They were in a real mess. So I often wondered what happened to them. I haven't met any of them since, but none of them would, of course, have gone back to action in Korea, I don't think, so that's why we wouldn't run into them. But that was a nasty experience. We then went forward. I think it was about there that one of our officers got an MC. And then we went forward to a village. I remember that the jeeps had to be sandbagged at that point because of roads could be mined. And then I started to think about the word being liberated, because it was used quite a lot in those days. And we liberated this village, which had been done over by the American Air Force. And the fact of the matter was there was hardly anything left standing. And I crossed my mind that this is a funny sort of liberation, because I thought, well, these people would perhaps have been better off without us there, you see. I won't say look to your conscience to see if you're on the right side, but it made you think quite deeply about it, whether it was morally right to go in and decimate the country of simple people who probably didn't give a damn whether they were communists or what they were. Their main concern was just to get enough food, because it was essentially a peasant society at that time. Anyway, there we are. Those were just thoughts that I had about it. Anyway, we settled in this village that we'd taken. I think, was it called Wei Guan? It might have been. I'd have to look it up on the map. And I took some pictures there. There were a lot of captured field guns, which were put in a big sort of village square, and they'd all been spiked, and I've got pictures of all the guns spiked. I put a Mills bob down them and let it go, and I got a picture of Gus taking a service in that square. But I remember going through the what houses were left standing, and finding a woman, which I remember particularly, a woman with a gunshot wound through her breast, and these things. So we just had to evacuate them, and what happened to them when they'd gone, I don't know. And there were quite a lot of civilian casualties there. After that, we were getting towards the time when the attack north went. I mean, the Pusan perimeter had been broken. The North Koreans really were retreating. There were a few prisoners brought in there, I can remember them. And we started to just went by road further north towards Seoul. And it was shortly after that time that the Incheon landing took place. So there wasn't really any fighting. It was just quiet, as I remember it. We were just travelling. And I don't know where we were. I think we might have been somewhere near Wijongbu, which is north of Seoul. And I remember, one interesting thing happened on the trip. We found, I think he was a BBC reporter, had no transport. And so we gave him a lift, and it was Rennie Cutforth. He was quite a famous reporter. I think he's dead now. Is Rennie Cutforth dead? Probably.
Possibly.
I think so, yeah. I remember crossing the Han River, and it was starting to go cold. And we were still in Jungle Green, which was the kit that we'd gone out from Hong Kong in. And then the weather started to get really cold. So we sent back to the base in Pusan for our winter kit. And the message came back that it wasn't there. It had, in fact, all been looted. And it was suspected that it was our own base troops who had sold the stuff on the black market. Whether that was true or not, I don't know. That's pure hearsay, so there's no way I can substantiate that or anything. But that's what we were told. And if that was the case, whether the culprits were ever caught and punished, I've no idea. But I do know that I finished up wearing... I had, for some silly reason, I had several pairs of pyjamas in the regimental aid post where no one ever got into pyjamas. And these had been supplied by the Americans because all the medical stuff was American. Everything was American. And so I put several pairs of pyjamas on over my Jungle Green. And eventually I finished, I got a big coat from, which was, it was off a dead American officer. And it all sounds like a dream, does this, doesn't it? And you put your feet in, and it zipped up. It zipped right up here, and it came right down to your ankles. And it was beautifully warm. So I wore that, and everyone wore whatever they could get their hands on. So all our troops were in strange things, like, you know, a lot of it American, cast-offs and all sorts, anything to keep them warm. And when the really cold weather came down, the troops would keep warm in a foxhole by lining it with straw, putting a poncho over the top, and at one end of the foxhole they put a, this is if they were out in the open, you know, at night, and they put a candle, and the poncho did seem to keep the frost off, and it did seem to keep them warm. They were all right. So frostbite was really quite rare. I don't think we saw very much. They were very resourceful in the way they dealt with these things. Mm-hmm. Going back a little bit, I can remember a time when Colonel Mann called me to see the brigadier because he'd been told that he wasn't well. And indeed, we found Brigadier Code with his head in his hands in a jeep, sort of leaning forward and almost collapsed. And I think I must bow to Colonel Mann's more correct diagnosis. He said he's at the end of his tether. And the strain really had been quite terrific up to then. And I'm sure that I've often thought of that diagnosis when I've been putting others on. And so there was only one thing to do. We sent him back for a rest. And of course, he got better. But it was just an illustration of the heavy strain upon the senior officers there. And one other little note about medical supplies, because I discussed this with Colonel Mann and was able to reassure him that, because he was just asking, were we all right for supplies? And I was able to reassure him that we got more than enough from the Americans and that there was nothing we were short of in the medical sense. Then one day, as we were going north, we went into a house which had been used, obviously, for North Korean medical supplies. And I think there were anesthetics that we found and various other things, but we couldn't be sure because the writing was North Korean, so there was no way that we could read it. Otherwise, we might have taken them along and thought they might be useful. But in view of the fact that it was impossible to identify them, it would have been foolhardy to do that. That's just a by the by on this matter. We then started to move into North Korea, and we'd done the best to get as much winter clothing as we could by now. And I can remember going north and through Pyongyang, which was pretty flattened by the American Air Force. I think there was a bit of resistance there, but I can't remember very much about it. And then we travelled on northwards with the North Koreans retreating. I don't think one could catch up to them. Occasionally there'd be a roadblock in that the battalion would be moving forward. Usually, the Americans usually had a jeep in front. Then they would have one or two tanks. And then the rest of the infantry would come behind them. And if someone shot at them, the jeep and the tanks would stop, would back off, and an airstrike would be called in, you see. And I know our senior officers always said that the Americans wouldn't leave the roads. They just... It's got them into trouble on one or two occasions, I think. So there were events of that sort, and we went on north, but it's impossible for a medical officer to give you much in the way of military details because he's not privy to actually what's going on. And I can remember on the 5th of November, when we'd reached a town called Pakchon, that I think the Chinese came in. I remember it was bonfire night. That's what made... I'll never forget the 5th of November 1950. Certainly was bonfire night, and I think the Chinese had attacked. And I think that presumably, it might have been New Zealand field guns, or it could have been American, but they apparently were using them at point-blank range. You know, they were, I forget what the term they used, but they put the muzzles down and just fired. So there was quite a lot of trouble there. And then we certainly went a bit north of Pakchon, but then had to turn round and go into the big retreat because the Chinese had come in then. And then, as we retreated further, we got to a place called Kunyuri. Have you heard of
Yes.
Kunyuri? And there were an awful lot of casualties there. There were American casualties, there were Turkish casualties. I think that there were Filipino casualties there. I think there were Filipinos. And I can remember that it was a big field, like a paddy field, with quite a lot of wounded actually in it. We were just waiting for transport to take them back because it had become very cold. And there was a problem with the transport, because we hadn't got any transport of our own in the Middlesex, and the troops were transported by the Americans, and the troop transports were brought up. They were all driven by Negro drivers who were perfectly pleasant, but they were all making excuses to try to get back to their base. And we felt, well, if they go,